Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So hello, a wonderful hello to Amanda. Amanda Hall. Wonderful illustrator and author illustrator. It's wonderful to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very pleased to be here.
I was tickled pink that's very funny when you say that to an illustrator. I was tickled pink. Maybe there's a book here somewhere. When you agreed to be on the interview, before we start, I should mention that I am Mel Rosenberg, and I am the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network, calling you from a very somber Israel. And if there's an air raid siren, then you'll have to excuse me. We will regroup 10 minutes later. Amanda, how wonderful to have you. And I learned about your wonderful, magical gifts when I interviewed Jennifer Byrne earlier this year on her book and your book, How the Sea Came to Be.
Yep.
And I said, wow, I have to have this illustrator. This is incredible.
Thank you.
So a few words about this incredible book, which is going to win major awards. Speak about it a little bit, please.
Okay, well, I've been working with Erdman's Books for Young Readers. I've done several books with them. I love working with them. They're fantastic. They give the illustrator a lot of scope, which I love. They offered me this book. This was literally just before the pandemic broke out. And I was amazed by the text. I thought it was really powerful. I was kind of intimidated by it because it's sort of, it's an epic. What Jennifer has written is an epic, and the style of it was really powerful. And so went on holiday and sort of thought, well, can I come up with some ideas? Just tried to get my imagination going. Thought, can I take this on? And one of the reasons I wanted to take it on was because I used to collect fossils as a child, and I've always been really fascinated by natural history. I actually really enjoy illustrating natural history. But there was so much I didn't know when I started to look into it. But for me, what was amazing about the book, partly what was the amount of research involved, but also it was the pandemic. The pandemic really just kicked off just as I was starting to work on it. I managed to get to go to, because I'm living here in Cambridge in the UK, and obviously we've got amazing university here. There's a wonderful museum called the Sedgwick Museum of Sciences. I went along to speak to people there, which was helpful. Just to start my research, really. They put me in touch with another amazing person called Dr. Imran Rahman, who at the time was at Oxford Natural History Museum. And he's now at the London Natural History Museum, but he became our fact checker for the book, and Erdman's used him. So I was kind of in his hands. He sent me a lot of links. He looked over all my initial roughs, and he made suggestions about sort of incorrect facts. There's a lot of material out there on the internet, visual material, about fossils, and you know, the book isn't only about fossils, but so much of it is about sort of deep history, and it's really important to sort of understand as an illustrator what on earth you're going to draw and what it looked like.
Amanda, there you go again. What on earth am I going to draw? Answer: everything.
Yeah.
Starting with billions of years ago.
That's right.
Okay, some of my audience are able to see you, some right. can hear you. For yes. those who cannot see you, run out and buy this book. It's a classic. people are still going to be loving it 50 years from now. Show us a few of your favorite pictures, spreads, illustrations.
Yeah, from the book. Okay, I'm going to put my glasses on for this. I'm quite proud of particularly the opening ones, because they were such a challenge, the opening spreads. So here we have the fiery Earth being bombarded by, you know, stuff from outer space, asteroids and comets and so on. Then we have the Hadean Earth, which is... somehow the Earth started out with, volcanic hell on Earth, which, is a great challenge to illustrate. I actually used black watercolour paper, which I'd never used before, which is exciting. And with that, because I was using gouache, which is an opaque medium, it really worked so well against the black, you know, because it's so vivid. And then I worked into it with other materials and so on. And also I did some colour enhancement online, you know, on in Photoshop rather, with the help of the designer at Erdmann's, who, you know, guided me so it wouldn't get too over the top. Then we've got the steamy Earth, when the Hadean Earth is sort of finished, and we've got the Archean Earth, which is when everything starts to cool down. And this is where the rain starts to form, the first water on Earth. The heat from the Earth rises up and forms amazing clouds that encircle the Earth, as Jennifer's text says. And then we have the first rains, and these are kind of storms that go on for millions of years. The moon at this point was very much closer to the Earth, which again, I didn't know. So this is the first storms. My depiction, because nobody knows what they were like, really. But because the moon was so much closer,
it's huge. Amanda, I'm not going to say very much today because I'm in awe, and you're an illustrator. I don't know what to ask. But right. It's very interesting that the first part of the book is about the formation of the Earth, of which we know very little. And then you are brought to task to illustrate the Earth, which we're supposed to know about, and then to be precise. Yeah. So, like, there's two halves to this wonderful book. First half, go out and have a blast.
Yes.
And the second half, no. We want you to be true to science.
Yeah, well, I think it's more of a gradation into kind of knowledge and firm knowledge. So the next parts in the book are about very early life, the creation of bacteria and different, and then and so on.
Can you show us the first
book? Yeah, of course. About
the first spread about life and the
And this is the following spread after the floods, where the Earth has sort of cooled down, and we've got a sea covering the Earth, really, an ocean. Then this is my depiction for first life, So we've got from very, very, from sort of very tiny little cells, then they get more and more complex. It was really challenging to know what to do with this spread. I'm proud of this one. I did it actually in black line on film, and then I manipulated the color in Photoshop. Wow. So, and that worked, you know, I was pleased with the way that worked. And it gets more and more complicated. And the feeling I wanted was that it just went on expanding out and out and out. And I think this kind of fan shape does sort of get, it kind of captures that in a way. And it looks quite lacy and rather beautiful, I think. We've then got these very, the ones I really love are the Ediacaran creatures, which are the first complex creatures that people actually know about. And these are just very, very weird and extraordinary, and went in different phases. And they are still being contested. They're still being learned about by scientists. So this is like a snapshot of what people, scientists, know now. But, you know, it's going to change, you know, so this is as good as we, you know, as good as it gets at this moment in terms of accuracy. Nobody knows what colour these creatures were. So I had a bit of a field day with the colours. I could do what I wanted. And then we go on to more sort of things start firming up in terms of the evidence, scientific evidence. I'll let you say something if you want to, rather than me just talk at you.
That's very interesting that you describe it as a kind of a gradient of Amanda, do whatever you want to. No, do whatever the scientists
up to say. A point, always up to a point, you know.
So did you have more fun with the first half of the book?
Oh, not really, no. I mean, it was nice to try out this black watercolor paper. I really, really enjoyed the just painting onto it, and I used that for, I can't remember, maybe about four of the spreads. There's one later on in the book, the deep sea creatures, where you turn the book turns upside up on its side. I'll just show you, and that was again using the black background. But you can get these really fantastically glowing colours because of the contrast with the black, which I mean, colour for me is sort of, I don't know, one of the main reasons I like to illustrate in a way. And it's always fascinating. It's always a challenge. It always excites me, finding kind of combinations of colour. So, and those creatures, I quite like weird creatures. And again, the deep sea ones are very strange, unbelievable kind of bioluminescent creatures that make light in the dark.
So explain to me, as somebody who doesn't understand. So even if I were to give you a box,
yeah,
I would say illustrate this box, it's still exciting for you because you're going to figure out how to do it.
Well, nobody's asked me to do that. It would be a challenge. If I could do what I wanted with the box, then yes, yeah, yeah. So, but I think, you know, I don't enjoy drawing everything, I have to say.
What don't you like drawing?
I find some things more challenging than others. I think that... it's really hard to sort of put it into words. There are certain things that excite me to draw, and some things don't. I mean, figures, you know, people are actually a challenge. Animals for me are really easy I don't know about easy, but I respond to drawing animals. I think I've always kind of enjoyed it. I've always been drawn to that. And yeah, I think, children are really, really tricky. So always a challenge, you know, and I work at that. But some things I think come more easily than others. I like to be able to be stylized in my work. And so I'm not the right illustrator to, you know, if somebody wants somebody to do something realistic, I'm not really that person. You know, there are people much better at that than me. But I, you know, having said that, I do like to be accurate, sort of, you know, as I say, with nonfiction things. That's where the research comes in.
Yeah. Before we leave for a while, your wonderful new book with Jennifer, two things. I'd like you to read your favorite text from the book. Then I'm going to ask you a scientific question.
Ooh, right. Okay. Well, I'll read, in that case, if you're going to do that. I'm going to be careful. And I'm
No, you don't.
You've told me
Jennifer,
now.
So Jennifer's text.
Yeah, no, but I'm going to be careful if you're going to ask me a scientific question, because I've got to think, what can I answer? So I'm going to choose this this Ediacaran spread, which says, in Jennifer's words, a little twist here and a little turn there. They combined and they grew and they changed, and bigger and wider and longer they got in new forms as they all rearranged. So that's, you know, yeah, fantastic. And so such a good prompt for an illustrator. I mean, that's what I felt with Jennifer's text. You know, it's sort of juicy and, you know, visually kind of, gets your imagination going. So
it got my imagination going. And actually, I was a scientist for 30 years.
Oh, right. Okay.
Because of a course I took on how life might have come into existence.
Right.
About 3.5 billion years ago, give or take a few hundred million years.
Right.
And of course, nobody knows. No. And also in your book, there's no life, and then on the next page there's life. So what do you reckon happened? I know you're not a scientist, but what do you think happened?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting that the recent dust that's been gathered from the asteroid in space, they seem to have found some basis for life, the components of life in that dust so far. I mean, I know it's very early days. So
that's an old theory of people such as Francis Crick, that life started by a meteor that brought life to planet Earth. But that doesn't answer the question, because it started on another planet.
You mean, are you asking me a philosophical question?
Yeah, you don't have to answer the question. It's just something that we will never know, but it's like one of the great questions of the universe. Is that scientists agree that it started out with primitive bacteria. But there's a lot of theories on the chemistry.
Yes.
How you can have a cell in this primordial soup.
Yes.
That would turn into life.
Yes.
So when I read this book, I was excited on several levels.
Yes.
And now, so we're talking about life now. So we're going to segue into Amanda Hall's life.
Okay. So
tell us about your life, Amanda.
Okay. Well, I live in Cambridge now. I was born about 10 miles away from here, in a little thatched cottage, about 400 years old. My parents, I'm the youngest of four siblings. My parents, who are both dead now, were a long time ago now, but, you know, I think they were good people. It was a very creative household, I would say. I feel very lucky to have sort of had that childhood. My mum always enjoyed writing. I mean, she had a couple of books published during her life. And my dad My dad taught at art school here in Cambridge, which he was from Yorkshire. They were both from Yorkshire. In fact, they came down because he got a job here.
So, one thing, I've seen pictures of your house.
Yeah.
Your house looks something like out of a bloody fairy tale from the Middle Ages.
It does. I know.
And I've seen houses like this in England. They're like, they're like right out of, you know, some ancient story.
Yeah.
And what they're called, your house is called Thumple and Dub or something. Thuffle and Dub. These are the name of the houses.
You mean Wattle and Daub? That's what you're looking for. Yeah,
so your parents were not born there.
No. My father found it, the cottage.
Yeah.
He was a very practical guy and creative. He found it was due to be demolished. Nobody wanted those houses in 1950 when they moved to Linton, this village where I was born. So he bought it, and he actually did a lot of the work himself to restore it, and, you know, worked in with local people.
And he was also a musician.
No, he wasn't. My mum was. My mum sang, actually.
I could say that your parents bought the house for a song.
Yes, they did.
And neither of them smoked, I hope.
No, my mother didn't. My father smoked like a chimney.
In that thatched hut.
Yeah, fire risk and everything. But that was usual in those days. The houses, they're so small. I mean, neither of my parents are huge, which is good, because they've got beams that descend, and, you know, people are not used to them. They can really knock themselves out kind of walking into the house.
So you grew up in a bloody fairy tale.
I did, yeah, with a lovely garden and, you know, animals and pets and so on. On the edge of a village, a zoo arrived when I was about 10, just a few doors down, and they had lions and all sorts of things, and we could hear them. Anyone at that time could actually start a zoo up. You didn't have to have a license in those days there in the UK. So these people put the zoo together, and animals kept escaping, like Russian bears and things, and having to be, got rid of because there were wild animals and they're running down the road. There's a baboon that was on the roof of the woman over the road, this elderly woman. And she saw this baboon one morning dancing on top of her coal shed. And so, you know, it was sort of, it was an interesting place to live. We also had amazing people in our street, I think, who'd been attracted to buying these little cottages. And so it was a colourful sort of environment, you know. Yeah.
Baboons dancing on the roof. If I had a baboon dancing on the roof, I would probably hire him.
Yeah.
and so you grew up in this idyllic village.
Yeah. Yeah,
and your dad drew, and you became an artist. How did that happen?
I was surrounded by art, and it just was sort of natural to do it. My brother went to art school. He's 7 years older than me, and I just decided I'm going to go to art school. I think my idea when I was a child was I want to have lots of animals and draw them. That was what I thought my future was going to be. And, some bits of that have sort of remained, if you like, you know. So, and my dad, the other thing my dad did was to, he did a lot of costume and set designs for the college where he worked. So we had sort of, you know, he'd be building up these little kind of set designs on the kitchen, on the living room table, out of balsa wood and stuff. I remember him boiling up a load of tights for men in a kind of big vat, sort of, so they'd all be red, you know. And so things like that were happening around me, and, you know, because they all needed to be for this production. He made amazing hats out of things like floor mops and so on, because they were for the stage, you know, and sort of it was very inventive, what he was doing. And I there's something about putting on a production, and I to some degree, I think I feel as though illustrating a picture book is a bit like putting on a, you know, staging a drama, and you've, you know, you set the scene, you set the stage, you know, you find the costumes and all that. So there's sort of an equivalence. And so I think, you know, when, because I went to art school, I did foundation. I don't know if that is how it's structured there in the US, but here you do a sort of thing where you try out all sorts of different types of art. And the thing I felt comfortable with was just sitting, doing pictures, painting pictures. And that is how I kind of am. I like to apply myself. I mean, the picture book thing really suits me because I like to have a specific chunk of time where I'm really concentrating on doing one thing very intensively. And then I kind of almost forget about it and move on to a totally new thing. And I love the variety of that. I love working with, I mean, now I work with a lot of authors and have quite close relationships with them. People like Michelle Markell, who's a wonderful writer. We've done a couple of artist biographies together, one about Henri Rousseau and the other about Leonora Carrington. There's another writer called Dawn Casey, who's British, and we've done two folk tales together, one called Babushka. It's a traditional folk tale from Russia and Italy and so on. And then an Inuit tale called Little Bear, which came out fairly recently, published by Wisdom Tales. So, you know, I really value those relationships. So, you know, and again, they're all sort of, so everyone's voice is so different as an author, including my own, which I think I'm sort of still, you know, exploring in a way.
You took a fancy to illustration. How did you break in?
I went to art school here in Cambridge. I did my foundation year and decided to then apply. You then apply for your specialism. I applied to do illustration, and I in fact did it here at the same college as the foundation.
No, but how did you find an agent? How did you find a books?
Oh, sorry. This is,
how did you?
Oh,
did
sorry. You when I actually finished. Oh, sorry. Break into the illustration into yeah yes. publishing. So after. After 3 years of my illustration course, I then went to London and started to hawk my portfolio around, which is what you did in those days before the internet, you know, making appointments to see publishers in London, which is quite frightening, picking up the phone and saying, can I come and see you? And they actually mostly would. And they'd say, oh, you know, we'll let you know. And you thought, oh, great. And then, you know, nothing happened. And but I was living in London. I then started working for a really lovely guy called John Marsh, who lived in the south of London, and he was a designer, and he was doing a lot of stuff for Elsa OUP at the time, which was English language teaching for the Arab world. And I went down and helped with the design side of it. So I was doing paste up, where you, in those days you had, before computers, you had cow gum and stuff. And he would give me little bits of illustration to do, you know, so I was getting money for designing and so on, and, you know, just helping this kind of very basic level of design, sticking bits of paper down with type on. But I got the chance to do, you know, to actually start professionally working. I had before that, when I was at college, I actually got a chance to do some my first professional job, which was some cards, happy family cards. So, you know, I got things in my folio that were actually published, and that's always a massive help. So I, you know, spent a few years. I mean, that was 1979. I went down, and it took me a few years to really get established. It's not easy. But, you know, I met people along the way. I enjoyed the thing of putting myself out there. And slowly I started to get, you know, more work picture books and so on. And then it sort of, I had a few years in London where I wasn't really doing very much, and I started traveling, sort of exploring different parts of myself, really. Spent 6 months in Zimbabwe in 1984, and then came back and really buckled down. Came back to Cambridge and got a studio, and you know, that's when I really started sort of properly building up my career, which is now sort of 50 books later or whatever. You know, a lot.
Your first illustrated picture book for children.
Yeah, my first one was actually when I was first in London, and it was something I'd started at college, and it was Old Mother Hubbard and Her Dog, and I won't try and get it out now because that will involve me breaking things if I do that, but it was, that was in black and white, and it was a serendipitous occasion. I had some pictures that I'd drawn, and I went into this little amazing antiquarian bookshop in London, and the guy suddenly said, oh, hang on a minute, and phoned up this publisher and said, I'd like you to meet this young woman. And so they...
Amanda, listen.
Yeah.
You are amazing, incredibly internationally successful, talented, and so on.
Thank you.
But, you know, after interviewing about 120 published authors and illustrators...
Yeah,
isn't it always about this? You know, I was in this little pet shop, and I was in this little bookstore. You have to have the you have to have the goods, right?
Yeah.
When somebody asks to see your portfolio, you have to have a smashing portfolio. But it's like so many people I've interviewed have this story,
yeah.
You know, and it's incredible.
Yeah,
there's somebody I want you to meet.
If I may say, I think it was more chance for serendipity to happen in those times. I think it's so much more controlled now. It's very difficult for people coming out of college to break in that way. It's all online. It's mm-hmm. You know, they just don't get responded to. So I think
we need a new line. You know, serendipity isn't what.
Yeah.
We need to figure out a line like that. Serendipity isn't what it used to be.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So that's wonderful. And in the interim, you've written two of your own books, and you've illustrated well over 40 other books. Tell us a bit about the differences between being an author illustrator and an illustrator, because clearly, you've spent most of your career as an illustrator rather than an author illustrator. I'm intrigued by this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I illustrated this book, The Stolen Sun, which is the one that's coming out. It's going to be retitled Song of the Raven, and it's going to be, that's the one that's coming out in April next year by Wisdom Tales. I wrote this story.
One second, Amanda.
Yeah.
This one you've written also.
This one.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the one. Yeah. This is the one I wrote.
So in April I might have to have you back on the show.
You might do. Yeah.
I might.
That would be good, wouldn't it? That would be good.
Yeah. Serendipitous.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be great. I wrote the story without any regard for having to illustrate it. You know, it's such a different process. And then I was confronted by my own words and how I was going to realize them. And so that's kind of interesting. And I've actually just written another text recently and been working with Anna Olswanger, the agent, who's a literary agent and a great editor.
Whom we love. Hi, Anna.
Whom we love. And it was interesting because she has a group of people and we meet on Zoom sometimes. And I was saying how difficult it is to go from the writing process into the illustration process. And I'm still, I mean, I've had a lot of things I've been doing this year, and I'm still trying to kind of, I've completed the text. It's all been approved by Anna and her readers and so on. And I'm now embarking on the illustrations. And yeah, it's just such a different sort of mindset. And I really, for the first time, I really enjoyed the writing. You know, before, I think it was more of a struggle, but this time I sort of, it was just my imagination was coming up with words, you know, which is sort of in a way that I hadn't really experienced before. So now I've got to kind of get those taste buds going with the illustrations, if you like. And my life's been very busy with all sorts of online. I've got an online shop that I'm working on, and that's devoured most of my year, to be honest, getting a print shop up and running and so on, which I'm nearly ready with. And I think that, you know, that's the thing with creativity. You just need to have that space to be immersed. And I keep trying to kind of immerse myself in the imagery, but it's hard to, you know, then you're jerked out of it and then you're doing something utterly different. And I need to kind of really have that time uninterrupted. So I'm just kind of can.
If you know.
Percolate.
Sorry, Amanda, if you know that you're going to illustrate a story that you're writing,
yeah,
then doesn't that impact on the text? Because, you know, I don't want to go there. I have to illustrate children. And I won't do that. this is what I've always wondered about, because I don't illustrate. But when I write, I want to leave lots of room for the illustrator. But if it's a child, then it's a child. But if I were an illustrator, say, oh, no, I don't know how to draw a child. I'll turn it into a dancing baboon.
I don't know. That's not how it works for me. I mean, I found the subject and it's something I really was interested in. And again, done loads of research into this. I mean, I think it's an interesting idea. It's actually a biography. Again, it's a nonfiction book about a woman who was an amazing scientist. And, you know, so I'm really, really interested, and an environmentalist, and, you know, a sort of absolute pioneer. So I'm interested in the subject matter. So my task is now how to illustrate it. And what I, with the text, when I was writing it, I was thinking in terms of spreads, I will say that, and sort of as a concession to my future self as the illustrator of this book.
No, but we have to do that too, as you know.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
So, I will be very excited to see these books in the hatching.
Yeah.
How many projects do you work at simultaneously? Because I read on your website that you can spend a few weeks making one final drawing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, really, I just mainly work on one project. And I, you know, I'm absolutely steeped in it. That my work's really labor intensive, as you can probably see. So there's a whole rough process and so on, and then refining that, getting approval from the publishers and so on. But yeah, the actual artwork generally would take me about 3 weeks, probably. I mean, Jennifer's story, How the Sea Came to Be, actually took 3 years to execute. I mean, it was during the pandemic, so it was sort of slow because everything was sort of slowed down, I think, and there was a lot of research. But yeah, you know, it's hard to be wrenched out of that when I'm in that kind of, mm-hmm. you know, living it, living that particular book, to do something else, you know.
Okay, but if you say that you've done. I just had this, I'm going to ask you like a little bit of a personal question.
Yeah.
You can answer, or you can say baboon dancing on the roof, which means ask me something else. Let's say that you've illustrated 50 books, which is about right. And let's say you got an average of $20,000 per book. How much is that?
But it's not like that, because, you know, that's over a massive amount of time. And
So what I'm saying is, it's like $1 million, but it's like over decades.
Yeah.
Of hard work.
Yeah.
And is it like, can you be rich being, I mean, you're a famous illustrator. You can turn down work. You're working for Erdman and the best publishers in the world. And can you make a good living doing this if it takes you so long to illustrate one book?
That's a very good question. It's very difficult. Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, you know, the money per book now is pretty good, but it takes me so long because of my style. So that's why I'm doing the other things in
yeah, I was looking work. At it, you know, other illustrators,
merchandising, you know,
they do this and they do that and they, yeah. You know, they mish and they do everything on the pads.
Mm.
And you have this process where you wet the page and you stretch it and then...
Yeah.
And then you count to 1,000 and then you wait a week and then you do it on the pencil and then you do the drawings with the color pencils and then you take out, you rub the.
You've followed it. Yeah.
Jews are going to say, oy vey. This is really hard work.
Yeah. But that's what a lot of illustrators still work by hand, you know, and I mean, it
no, I congratulate you. I think that you're
amazing. Yeah, thank you.
I'm so happy you spent the last 41 minutes talking to me. It's incredible. I think you're incredible. I'm a big fan. Everybody run out and buy Jennifer and Amanda's book. So because we have spoken for 41 minutes, it's been a lot of fun. And it's getting towards evening, so we may we may be bombed soon. I want to ask you a question which I ask the illustrators.
Mm.
And that is, do you feel hard done by?
No, on balance, no.
But you know why I'm asking this question?
Not entirely, no.
Well, because the books are, you know, Jennifer Byrne and Amanda Hall. And and sometimes the illustrators, you know, the font is smaller
than
the font of the author. You know, like I had another career, but my first picture book just came out. And I noticed that on the cover, my name is in Hebrew, mind you, is bigger than the illustrator, and she made the cover.
Right. Okay.
And this book wouldn't be the book without her artwork.
I mean, I think, you know, to be honest, I get my name is the same size as the authors, mostly. What I regret is that books aren't catalogued under the illustrator's name. That is, like, really crucial, and I wish they were. So, you know, it gives us a sort of invisibility, which I think is a real shame. And, yeah, that's annoying. But you know, I don't want to be in a battle with authors, you know, about that stuff. But I think there is a kind of a perceived sort of hierarchy in some way, it shouldn't really be there, because you know, it's a collaboration when it comes to it of words and an image, and they should support each other, and they should be equal, really. Although, you know, it's the writer who generates the idea, you know, you have to say that.
Yeah.
And the illustrator responder, you know. So I think it's a bit like being a singer and singing somebody's song. It's a bit like that as well, as a singer, you know, and a singer who doesn't sing much now. Yeah.
But, you know, like if you have a singer and if you have a songwriter and the person writes the music, then they both get equal footing, you know. It's Lennon and McCartney, or McCartney and Lennon, or whatever you want. It's Rodgers and Hammerstein. It's not Rodgers and Hammerstein.
But if it's somebody else's song entirely, and then somebody else sings it, you know, then sort of who gets the billing? It depends on the fame, I suppose, of the, you know, whoever's the most famous.
Yeah, like the most famous song of the previous century is not the Masochism Tango. It's a song called Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Right.
And most people will not be able to tell you who wrote it.
No, that's absolutely true. Yeah.
Yeah. But we're almost at the music. So let's talk a little bit about music. So in addition to your fantastic and wonderful illustrating career and writing, you're also you call yourself a semi-professional musician. What is a semi-professional musician?
I think it's when you're not doing it full time, really. You know, it's not it's never been my main career, although I wonder at some time, you know, at points whether it should be.
No, but you get paid for it, don't you?
Yeah, not a lot, mostly.
Well,
you know.
Yeah, who pays musicians a lot?
Well, true.
It's worse than being an author or an illustrator.
Yeah. Okay, I was a professional musician then.
Yeah. I think so. Give yourself some credit here. Okay. And you go to bars and you have a partner who plays a wonderful accordion and you're a marvelous singer.
This is all kind of pre-2017. So,
Amanda, everything is pre-2017.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
So a few words about that shtick.
Yeah. I've been in bands and so on for many years. My partner Richard is also a musician, and we were in a band together with eight people and so on. So yeah, it's something I've always loved. And then Dawn and I got together. She plays fantastic piano accordion. And I fancied doing a cabaret duo. So we did that. We were called the Little Black Dress Duo. And we did gigs around town here in Cambridge. And it was really great fun, you know.
And in addition to Tom Lehrer, whom I love,
yeah.
And by Beer Miss Duchesne, what other songs do you sing?
Oh, gosh. We did, let me just see, As Long As He Needs Me from Oliver, which Nancy's song, which I loved doing. I mean, I'm a big Bob Dylan fan. This is like going back in sort of to, you know, childhood and so on. So I play guitar.
But I hope you're referring to the early Dylan.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where he basically borrowed other people's songs.
Well, he rewrote, I mean, he was very clever and you know, early folk songs and so on, and he rewrote those to some degree.
I grew up on that.
Yeah, me too. And I still, actually, those are the ones that I come back to now. I kind of, you know, pick my guitar up and kind of, they still are sort of emotionally very kind of, I'm very connected to those because they were kind of in an early part of my life.
I asked you whether you wanted to sing for us. and under other circumstances, I would sing together with you.
Uh-huh.
We are going through a horrific war, and you have brilliantly taken my mind off of it, and it's been wonderful having you. Before we go, though, I want to mention this quote of Lewis Carroll, which I found on your website, and he writes, Lewis Carroll, of course, Charles Dodgson, from Alice in Wonderland. And what is the use of a book, thought Alice, without pictures or conversation?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was a fantastic quote to use. You know, it's just, and I've always loved the Alice, John Tenniel images. I think they're fantastic.
Even though Lewis Carroll, at some stage, did not get along with Tenniel, right?
Yeah, did he not? I don't know. Didn't know that.
I think they ended up having a row. I can't remember.
Okay.
But I think that this connection between authors and illustrators that gives us these marvelous picture books, is incredible. And I'm just going to tell you one final little story because after my career doing other things, I've finally gotten around to doing what I should have done 50 years ago. But when I was a five-year-old, when you were a five-year-old, what books did you love? What are your favorite?
Oh gosh, I was thinking about this. We had things like Ladybird books, and they had wonderful illustrations in of a lot of ones of animals and so on. There was one called the Discontented Pony. They were very moralistic, and they were very kind of depressing in a way. But the pictures were fantastic, you know. And yeah, so that's an example.
I grew up in Canada on Madeline.
Okay.
Bemelman. So this is imprinted in my mind forever. And I just tell you one little thing before we go. We had two stories of Peter Pan.
Yeah.
Illustrated by two different illustrators. Different publishers, different illustrators.
Yeah.
It drove me nuts. I couldn't sleep at night. I was this 4 or 5 year old, and I was plagued by this dilemma. I would say to my daddy, "Daddy, which of these is the real Peter Pan?"
Yeah. Very difficult.
So in your portrayal of the universe, Amanda, you have created a real universe of your own.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And I'm so grateful that you were on the show. So Amanda Hall, a illustrator of so many wonderful books and author, let's meet again under better times.
Yeah.
I wish I had known you. I was in Cambridge 5 years ago. We could have had a little gig, but I didn't know you then. But now I know you. And it was wonderful talking with you.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to see your new books. And I'm Mel, before I forget who I am, I'm Mel Rosenberg, and I'm the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network. And it has been a singular privilege and wonderful, almost an hour, where I've been sitting and talking from afar with the amazing Amanda Hall.
Well, thank you so much, Mel. I've really enjoyed it, and it's been fantastic to meet you. And I wish you well.
Thank you very much. We need those wishes.
We do. Yeah. Okay.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye-bye.